Good morning, and welcome to the Jewish Policy Center conference call. I'm Shoshana Bryan, Senior Director of the JPC and your host. As most of you know, the Jewish Policy Center is a 501c3 organization providing perspectives and analysis of foreign and domestic policy. The JPC supports a strong American defense capability, U.S.-Israel security cooperation, and missile defense. We support the legitimacy and security of Israel against anyone who would deny them. As an organization that sits slightly to the right of center, the JPC advocates for small government, low taxes, free trade, fiscal responsibility, and energy security, as well as free speech and intellectual diversity. We have a great turnout today for an excellent guest, and we appreciate that so many of you are circulating the invitation to your friends. Let me encourage you to continue to do that. I also want to thank you for the many excellent questions we've received. As you know, you cannot ask questions directly during the call, but our email line is open and monitored, so send your questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. That's info@jewishpolicycenter.org. In this series of calls, we've been trying to shift people's focus from the health aspects of the COVID-19 virus pandemic to its impact on the internal and foreign policy challenges for the United States government. Today, we're looking at economic challenges. We're very pleased to have as our guest, James Capretta, who holds the Milton Friedman Chair at the American Enterprise Institute, AEI. He studies healthcare, entitlement, and U.S. budget policy, as well as global trends in aging, health, and retirement programs. You can see why he is the perfect guest for today. Concurrently, he serves as a senior advisor to the Bipartisan Policy Center, and since 2011, as a member of the advisory board of the National Institute for Healthcare Management Foundation. He spent more than 16 years in public service before joining AEI as an associate director of the White House Office of Management and Budget from 2001 to 2004. Earlier, he served as a health policy analyst at the U.S. Senate Budget Committee and the U.S. House Committee on Ways and Means. From 2006 to 16, Mr. Capretta was a fellow and later a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He's been widely published in newspapers, magazines, and trade journals, and is frequently sought after as a guest for television appearances and conference calls. He's a contributor to Real Clear Policy, where he regularly publishes commentary on public policy issues, which is where he wrote an article entitled, "The Debt Cleanup That Awaits Us," which is why we invited him here today. We hold our calls to 45 minutes. We started that long ago when most of you were working at your desks and this was your lunch hour filler, but it still seems like a good idea. So let's get started. Remember questions to info@jewishpolicycenter.org. Jim, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you very, very much for inviting me today. I'm so pleased to join this group, and thank you to the Jewish Policy Center for organizing this call and for the work you do, which I very much applaud and support the short mission statement that Shoshana read, very admirable and very consistent with sort of AEI's perspective on these matters. So great to be with you today to talk about this immense challenge that's going on right now. The article that Shoshana referred to was just my summation of sort of the difficulty that we've drifted into here and how we're going to think about it, or how we should think about it in the months and years that unfold here going forward. So just to provide some background, even before the crisis hit, the federal government had been, as I said, drifting into a major fiscal problem. We had come, of course, through the deep recession in 2007 to 2009 was a demarcation point fiscally for the country. Up to that point, debt held by the public, that is, you know, borrowing that has occurred in public markets outside the government, had hovered between, you know, 30% and 40% of GDP. And at the end of 2008, it was just at about 40% of GDP. Then the financial crash hit and it spiked up. And for the last decade or so, it's been ramping up slowly toward about 80% of GDP. This all occurred against the backdrop of an aging population where entitlement spending was creating more and more pressure fiscally inside the federal budget and was about to create even more pressure in the next two decades or so as the baby boom generation went into its retirement years. So that was sort of the backdrop. And then, of course, President Trump came into office in 2017. And in the last 3 years, it has to be said that even with a Republican administration that seems somewhat committed to trying, at least on paper, to push back on some spending, deficits have gone up even more. There was, of course, the tax provisions, and in successive bipartisan agreements with the Congress, very large increases in spending were approved, both for defense and non-defense programs in the appropriation cycles. And so we've had a pretty big run-up in debt even prior to the pandemic hitting, which has left us incredibly vulnerable to a debt problem, you know, compounding the economic problem, compounding the health problem, all ensuing here from this public health crisis. So that brings us to sort of where we are now in the last couple of months. In successive pieces of legislation, Congress has added approximately $3 trillion or so to the expected deficit in 2020 and more than $1 trillion in 2021. This is through the small business support programs, through the additional spending through the public health infrastructure, through the money set aside for purchasing vaccines, to support the hospital systems, to support research and investigation into therapies. Now, going down the list, there's just a lot of money being going out the door in the federal government, and it's going to, you know, in a very rapid time period. And so it's pushing up debt at a clip that really hasn't been seen before, frankly, in the U.S. history. And so we're in uncharted waters, and upshot is that in 2020, we're going to run, according to the Congressional Budget Office, an annual deficit of about 18% of GDP. And that may be optimistic because there's likely to be new legislation passed later this month and perhaps another one during the summer that also expand the deficit in 2020. So, you know, we're talking about a deficit just in 1 year of about 20% of GDP. CBO expects it to moderate somewhat next year as perhaps some normalcy starts to resume. But still, at the end of 2021, the combined deficits of this year and next year would push debt as a percentage of GDP up to above 100% of GDP and really up maybe around 108% of GDP. Now, keep in mind, just to kind of put some perspective around these things, the average annual deficit has been about 3% of GDP going back to World War II. Okay, so it's having a deficit that's 18 or 20% of GDP in 1 year. That's, you know, basic. It's just not something that we've had to deal with before. And then secondly, as I already indicated, at the end of 2008, debt as a percentage of GDP, accumulated debt, not the annual deficit, was 40% of GDP. And at the end of 2021, we're going to be at 108% of GDP. So, you know, we are well beyond anything even that occurred at the end of World War II and the years that followed. Now, the question then is how to think about this. Should we be worried in the immediate moment? Should we take action right now to offset some of the spending, et cetera? My own point of view is that at the moment, we shouldn't do anything to try to rein in current deficits, that the crisis is so acute, unusual, unprecedented, and damaging that I do not think now is the time to try to scale back on these commitments that are being made to try to A, accelerate a health intervention that could really bring an end to all of this, which actually is obviously wise, or B, to kind of support the economy until that kind of health intervention can come along. So I think now is not the time to sort of put front and center on the congressional or administration agenda deficit reduction or debt concerns. Having said that, one can note that our problem right now is particularly acute in large part because we weren't worried about it 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years ago when we should have been. That, you know, when times are good, that's the time to get your fiscal house in order, because bad things do happen. Recessions do occur. Obviously, this one is far more acute than anything we've ever experienced, but you know, it's always prudent to prepare for a rainy day, and of course now is like a hurricane, and we didn't. And so this rapid run up in debt is occurring, you know, is being piled on top of sort of fiscal irresponsibility that has allowed, you know, but both parties, this is not pointing fingers at any party or any individual, but both parties have allowed this situation to occur over a long period of time. And now we're having to borrow massive amounts in an emergency on top of amounts we probably could have avoided if we had gotten our act together earlier. So that's a real shame because it puts us behind the eight ball. However, I think the way then to look forward is to kind of realize we're still facing the same basic problem that existed pre-pandemic, which is that there's a large mismatch, and even separate and apart from the crisis spending, there's just a large growing mismatch between the revenue base of the country and its entitlement commitments. No matter how you look at it, there's just no way to see ourselves getting into a better fiscal position just by making cuts in the annual appropriated accounts for the operations of the regular government or defense. Both of those, obviously, there's a big commitment to defense that's occurred in the last couple of years, and I think rightly so. Given the world situation, one, it's hard to quibble with making an investment on the defense side. And then on the domestic side, you know, large run-up in spending has occurred as well. There's always room for cutting in the government. There's always room for making efficiency. There's always room for scaling back on these things. But you're never going to balance the budget or get ourselves into a better fiscal position by looking at the annual appropriated accounts. They're too small relative to the size of the problem. This is fundamentally a question of revenue and entitlement spending. And entitlement spending, by that I mean the big ones: Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and, you know, things like retirement programs for federal workers and social welfare spending. All of that combined is 2/3 of the budget and growing. And as the population ages, Social Security and Medicare in particular are really going to push up spending very rapidly in the coming years. CBO projects that under a somewhat optimistic scenario, debt to GDP will reach, this is pre-pandemic they made this forecast, that debt to GDP will rise to 150% of GDP in about 3 decades' time. A more pessimistic scenario shows it going even higher to 180% of GDP. And that's all driven by revenue being relatively stable and growing a little bit over time, but a massive run-up in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid spending from an aging population and rising health spending per capita. And that's all pre-pandemic. So you can imagine, here we are already headed toward 110% of GDP, pile on top of that an aging population and rising health expenses. I mean, it's a recipe for a fiscal challenge of epic proportions here. And so what do we do about it? Well, I think we're just back in the same boat we've always been in, which is one has to kind of think through how to get the entitlement programs on a less pronounced upward trajectory. They're still going to grow. And what kind of revenue can be raised to pay for those programs and pay for the rest of the government as well. Obviously, neither party is really, this is one of the points I make in the piece, there's just ample evidence that neither party is strong enough on their own to solve this problem. You're not going to get a Republican plan to straighten out our fiscal policy with big entitlement cuts and tax increases that the Democrats oppose and so on. It just isn't going to happen that way because they're too fearful politically. And same with the Democrats. I mean, even pursuing, if you just wanted to just solve all this on the revenue side of the House and just raise taxes to a very high level, even on rich people or supposedly rich people, the politics of that are still not great for the Democratic Party. And so they talk about it quite a bit, but they never actually put too much on the table just because it's unpopular politically. So I think, the only way forward is going to end up being, the two parties compromising and taking bites at this slowly but surely over time once the crisis subsides. And what I would say is the goal would be to first stabilize debt as a percentage of GDP over the next decade. The idea of balance is sort of a fantasy at this point. We're so far removed from that. And then try to get a goal of keeping debt to GDP below 100% of GDP, but maybe back down to where we are right now, 80% of GDP in a certain number of years. So I think the first step in the process may be, and this is something I've been working on and thinking through myself along with some others, is what kind of fiscal rule, what kind of fiscal rule could the country agree to that kind of could get everybody started and pointed in the same direction? And that's really missing from our politics today and our legal process today. If you think about it, the U.S. government really doesn't even have any kind of budget plan. There is no time when the government says, here's what we're trying to do fiscally as a whole, across the board, and here are the goals and the targets and the process that helps us get to that target and so on. There's a budget process, but it's quite messy and somewhat dysfunctional, and it certainly doesn't have an agreed-upon goal at this point. So I think part of the process might be going forward might be, after the crisis subsides, see if the policymakers, see if Congress and the administration can enact a law saying, hey, our goal here is to hit X percent of debt as a percentage of GDP should be held to no more than X percent by 2030. Maybe that would be the starting point, or 2040. And then back off from there and say, what do we got to do to hit that goal? And then there'll be a big argument about it, of course, and lots of disagreement. But if first they agree, this would be the target, I think that would be at least a good start and start to point, elected leaders and people running for office, and everybody would start to say, okay, the country now has been told this is our target. Hey, what's your idea for getting there? And you sort through the various competing ways of doing it and start to make maybe some progress on the goal. But again, I think the big pieces are going to have to be entitlement reform and revenue. You can make some savings here and there in the appropriated accounts, but they're really way, way, way too small relative to the size of the problem. This is really a question of what level of taxation the country is ready to tolerate, as well as big benefit commitments and how they can be handled going forward. One last point I'd make there is that in 1983, Social Security was its trust funds were near insolvency. And there was a bipartisan process to try to, quote, save Social Security. And it worked. But one of the main provisions in that bill was controversial at the time, but it basically raised the retirement age, the so-called normal retirement age for Social Security from 65 to 67 on a very gradual basis over multiple decades. In fact, we're not even done with the phase-in of that. I think it ends in 2027. And the point I'd like to make about that is that although it was controversial when it was enacted and there were people saying, oh, it's terrible, they're raising the retirement age, the phasing of it has been so gradual and so moderated that, you know, you basically never hear anything about it. Certainly you don't ever hear anybody proposing to repeal it. And the public has largely accepted it, and it's just part of the rules now of Social Security, and there's no controversy around it. It was done on a bipartisan basis, and that certainly helped. But the same thing could be done again. We could raise the retirement age for Social Security to perhaps 69, do another 2 years over the next few decades, and something similar for Medicare. Maybe it needs to go up a little bit. If it's done in the context of a health system where people feel secure in their insurance, that can be done. And so I think these are the kinds of ideas that are going to have to be put on the table to do very gradual and moderated changes in the programs that once enacted, there'll be a lot of heat around it when it's put on the table and perhaps legislated. But once in place, if it's done on a bipartisan basis, I think the country will be surprised by how quickly it becomes just accepted and non-controversial. So I think I'll perhaps stop there because I do want to make sure we get to all the questions that people might have and engage in, you know, and those topics as well.
We probably won't get to all the questions anyway, but let's take a start. First question, which is actually a two-part question. You're arguing for bipartisan cooperation on managing the debt to GDP ratio, but you also said we ignored the problem before, and particularly Republicans, if they were bipartisan at all, moved toward the spending side with the Democrats. Here's the question. Do you think the pandemic and the situation that's arisen forcing us to look at it will also force cooperation that wasn't there before? Second part of the question, what congressman is likely to risk his job to these days? And third, actually, it's a three-part question. What are the bureaucrats to ignore the national debt?
I'll admit, Shoshana, that some of the audio for your question kind of came in and out on my reception. I apologize. I think I got parts of what you said. And then after I answer, maybe you can tell me what I missed, okay?
Okay, let's try that.
So, in terms of the bipartisanship aspect of this, I think the question is certainly right that pandemic has struck, and you know there's been a certain amount of bipartisanship lately, but of course it's in a massive response and on the opening the spigot spigot aspect of it, and if we get to the point where after the crisis starts to subside, will the public say to the elected leaders, hey, we want some bipartisan cooperation too on how do we get out of this debt mess we've created? I think there might be a little bit of truth to that. I think that might actually happen. But it's probably going to take a couple of cycles of elections and campaigns and realization about how bad the problem is before, you know, you might see some serious action. I don't think you're going to see it necessarily in 2021 or 2022 because the pandemic and its aftermath will probably still be fresh. But maybe by 2023 and beyond, you'll start to see a growing realization that we can't keep going like this, that something needs to be done to get the House in more and better shape fiscally, and that could put pressure back on the congressman. I do think that, as I indicated, I think the first step is some agreement that, you know, what is the actual goal at this point? Republicans used to talk about balancing the budget. That goal is just not, it's so short term. It doesn't really deal with the big question, which is how does the country deal with its massive long-term challenge? And which, by the way, is a challenge that we're kind of in the beginning stages of at this point. So it's not something that is so far off as being kind of, you know, not worth worrying about. So I don't know if that's helpful. Maybe Shoshana, you can give me the rest of the question now.
It was more of a political thought by one of our listeners. What congressman would risk his job to be bipartisan these days? But a technical question.
Is it true? Well, the two seems to be a pretty small number of people at this point. But, you know, if you look at the polling data, I will tell you that, you know, obviously our electorate has become more polarized, and there's obviously a lot of political combat going on. But, you know, there's still a, when you ask, you look at the polling data, there's still a pretty big appetite out there in the country for solving problems, getting things done, cooperating, and making incremental progress. And I think, you know, there's a underappreciated aspect of this, which is that once you do these things, it's controversial maybe why you're doing it, but once it's done, there's a lot of political protection when you do things on a bipartisan basis, because attacks from the other side are more are muted because they've agreed to it as well. Obviously, you're vulnerable to a primary challenge more, but you know, that may not be quite as strong in the years ahead as it's been in the last couple of years.
Okay. We had a technical question. Is it true that the government budget rises by some percentage points annually automatically? Is there an incremental rise, and can that be stopped?
Well, there are provisions embedded in big programs and also in the tax law that automatically adjust for inflation. So Social Security benefits are indexed to inflation, so they go up automatically. Moreover, Medicare payments to providers, that is hospitals and physicians, go up automatically by some indexing factor, although it's below the general rate of inflation. And on the tax side, tax levels do go up through something called bracket creep. That is, the brackets that define which rate you pay in the income tax system, they're indexed to CPI, the Consumer Price Index, but wages and incomes, of course not right now, but generally grow at a faster rate with the rate of the economy. And so you have more and more people going into higher income brackets each year, they pay higher income taxes, so the revenue base of the country has a steady growth to it. That sort of offsets the steady growth on the spending side from the indexing of the big programs I just mentioned. So yeah, there's some automatic growth in our government tied to inflation, basically. But a lot of programs, you know, the appropriated accounts, there's nothing magic about that. They can be cut. They could be, Congress has the power to do whatever they want on an annual basis. And so there's no guarantee that programs grow every year, although Congress tends to support that for most programs.
Okay, here's a question for us. We are presently spending a lot of money. Does this amount to running the printing presses? And if so, what is the danger of a surge in inflation, which, as you just mentioned, may up the rates on certain programs? Are we facing a possible surge in inflation?
I would say that we will eventually, the threat is out there eventually, given what we're doing, but one must be realistic that the economic, macroeconomic challenge of the last decade really has been sort of in the opposite direction, the inability of policymakers to generate inflation despite their wish to see it. That, in other words, there's been more deflationary pressures than inflationary pressures, from a glut of global savings searching for adequate capital investment. And so you've just got a lot of people saving a lot of money and parking it into safe investments, and that's put huge downward pressure on inflation across the board. And, you know, so having said that, though, we're running the printing presses at a really massive rate right now. And a lot of that printing of money is basically being used to buy treasury securities that are being issued by the federal government. So in a classic sense, we are monetizing the government's debt. And that's always been everywhere a recipe for inflation. Now, the U.S. is a little different because we're the world's reserve currency. So putting money into treasuries is still considered basically the safest investment anywhere, because it's a dollar denominated instrument, and you know, it's got the faith and credit of the federal government behind it. So people expect it to be paid back, and it's in a dollar-denominated instrument, and everybody wants to put their money into dollar-denominated instruments because it's safer than other currencies. So, you know, you put all that together, and there's lots of things that sort of suggest, well, we could keep doing this for a while. So I think this is a sort of an on the one hand, on the other hand story. And it's like the old thing, how did you go bankrupt, you know, gradually and then suddenly, right? So this is one of those things where we might be okay for a long time, and then all of a sudden a flip switches and people say, hey, wait a second, you know, you were strong and you were stable when you were at 50% of GDP in debt, but now you're at 150 and we're not so sure anymore. And so, you know, the country could squander its position if it's not careful, at which point we would have inflation, we would have people taking money out of treasuries, and we would have lots of problems.
Thank you. Question: should Congress bail out state? Now we're going to get to the practical things in the middle of this situation. Should Congress bail out state and local governments with severely unfunded and underfunded pension programs, or what is the implication of letting them go bankrupt?
Well, on the second one first, my understanding is that the bankruptcy code, you know, specifically has written, federal bankruptcy code is specifically written into it that say local government, municipalities, counties, school boards, and things like that can declare bankruptcy. So that's allowed and has happened many times now. But I guess there's a broad consensus that states can't do it, A, because they weren't specifically mentioned in the bankruptcy code as being an entity that would be allowed to go bankrupt, and B, because I think there's sort of an understanding in constitutional law going back to a couple cases in the last century saying that states have an obligation under a certain interpretation of one provision of the Constitution to not, you know, renege on their debt obligations. And so, you know, I think it's probably a long shot to assume that you could sort of rewrite all of that quickly and allow states to figure out how to go bankrupt. They could potentially put it into the bankruptcy code, but then, you know, there might be a constitutional question that would have to be settled. So short of that, I think we're probably looking at, you know, whether or not a bailout and some other mechanism could be done. I don't favor an across-the-board bailout program because of the moral hazard it would create. And there's been, you know, a lot of states have taken very tough decisions to get their pension systems under better control. And it would be a real shame if federal taxpayers had to reward the states that just couldn't do that for a lot of political and internal state reasons. And so I don't favor that. And I have a feeling Congress is not going to favor it either, just because the internal politics of the Congress would make it very difficult to do.
Thank you. We have a double question again. First, in terms of recovery, economic recovery from the pandemic, can the United States recover economically largely on its own, or must Europe and even China recover substantially as well? Second part of the question is, consumer spending is often said to be the major driver of the U.S. economy. We are entering a different way of life with social distancing and self-isolation. How economic recovery depend on the development and deployment of a vaccine so that we can go back to going out and being around and spending our money?
Well, let me take the second part first, and I'll do the first. Yeah, I do think if we got a technological solution, that is either a really, really effective therapy that brought the fear factor around this down, or a vaccine that inoculated the population from contracting the virus, I think both of those things would allow, you would see a pretty quick try to resume with normalcy. Nobody likes what we're doing now. So, you know, some things would remain, but if you got a vaccine that allowed the air travel again and hotels to open up and, you know, things like that, of course, that would be a huge boost. So that's why the race to a vaccine is probably the the dominant and most important thing going on right now. Can the U.S. recover on its own without Europe and China and maybe even other parts of the world? I think the answer is it can partially, but not totally, right? This episode is probably going to pull back on globalism to some degree, but not totally. I mean, it's just impossible to. There's just too much connectedness. You know, most of our strongest and best companies in the United States are global companies, including the pharmaceutical company. They have operations all over the world and depend on sales all over the world. And so, if there's recessionary pressures in one part of the high-income countries around the globe, it'll affect growth here in the United States and vice versa. So we can partially recover, but not totally recover until everybody goes in the same direction, which is why, look, I'm not Pollyannish about it, but which is why I think some level of global cooperation on the vaccine effort, the distribution thereof, and how to, stem the tide of the pandemic globally, some perspective that is a global in this is appropriate, obviously.
Thank you. This goes right to the heart of your interests. Do the initial somewhat confused responses of American hospitals, drug suppliers, medical equipment testing companies, and so on and so forth, mean that our healthcare system is broken? Is this the time for more or complete federal control and provision of healthcare? Or is it time for more competition in healthcare?
Well, that's a big question. I think I'm in agreement with many people that say we're probably in the second or third inning of this whole thing, So we got a long way to go before we start judging, I think, how well or poorly various approaches have worked, right? Because you have to kind of work your way all the way through to the end to see if some decisions made early were better or worse, or designs of various systems were better or worse. An important distinction here is between the public health system and the medical delivery system. They obviously interact and intersect to some degree, but good public health protocols are in large part completely distinct from sort of bread and butter medical delivery by physicians and hospitals. And they involve controlling borders and monitoring disease spread, and they use tools that are not the same as administering therapies, to patients who come in for various ailments or need hospital care to, take care of heart problems or other things. And so I think it's important to kind of make a distinction between countries' public health structures and the larger health systems that take care of all the other things that come into play when trying to promote human health. And in that regard, the U.S., I think one could say, I think pretty clearly that there were deficiencies more on the public health side that have already been well documented, having to do with getting adequate supplies, being prepared for testing. I think that's probably the biggest shortcoming, not having high volume platforms kind of ready on a turnkey kind of basis. Obviously was something that left us blind to what was really going on the ground in the first couple of months. So I think there were shortcomings there that will probably be, long talked about and tried to be rectified. But in terms of the medical delivery system and how it's been taking care of patients and how it's responded to the crisis, I don't think there's anywhere near any evidence that says the U.S. has done poorly in that. In fact, the U.S. has a very, very, very good emergency ICU system in this country. It's not perfect, and maybe there aren't quite enough ICU beds, but I would say that, stepping back from even the New York metropolitan area, the crisis response there to make sure that there was adequate supplies, adequate beds, adequate personnel coverage, not perfect, but it was not the cataclysm that some people feared. And around the country, I think many hospital systems have been shored up. they are not experiencing overwhelming caseloads, and, you know, knock wood, we hope that that remains the case. So I think we're too early in this to sort of make judgments about all that. And in terms of what we need to do to fix American healthcare, I'm very much on the side of a good public health system that has to be funded by taxpayers, but a market-driven cost discipline approach that makes the system responsive to patient needs. That's very much where I've been.
Thank you. If we don't get a handle on this, if the debt continues to increase, what would a real debt crisis look like?
Well, I think the main one would be that, let's say we went to, you know, 125% of GDP in debt in the next decade or so, which is completely realistic. And some of the big purchasers of U.S. treasuries swing toward purchasing other instruments instead of U.S. treasuries. And demand falls for parking money in dollar-denominated, you know, treasury securities. That's the most likely and precipitating event. You know, the Chinese government and other institutional investors just dumped their treasuries and say, we don't want these anymore. And maybe some other countries, you know, say, well, we're going to put our money into, you know, euro-denominated instruments or whatever, you know. At that point, then you have to pay higher interest rates, you have inflation, and you have pressures to, it makes it very difficult to get out of a debt spiral because you have to borrow more to cover your debt obligations each year because interest rates are rising. So in a very benign environment like we have right now in terms of interest rates in the borrowing environment, it seems all okay. But if suddenly you have to pay people more to take your debt, you know, to lend you money, then you're in a world of hurt. And, you know, that's the precipitating, that would be the crisis.
Thank you. Our last question is a pessimistic question. Are higher taxes inevitable?
Yes.
Ow.
I'm sorry to say it.
Okay.
I can jump right ahead to the punchline, you know, which is that I don't see any way, you know, given our political system and how it works, I just don't see any way for revenue to stay at, you know, 18% of GDP even when spending commitments are going to go easily to 23 and 24% of GDP in the next, you know, not too distant future, right? So unless you have a plan to immediately take a hammer to Social Security and Medicare and bring their costs way down, not just slow their growth rate, but reduce them in size in a very near-term kind of perspective, which nobody has, then you're looking at tax increases to try to prevent the debt from spiraling out of control. Not just debt, not just the tax increase, though. I would never say that. I think there has to be a very major effort on longer-term entitlement reform, because otherwise the tax increases would be very, very prohibitive.
So we have a policy here of trying to end on a positive note. Unfortunately, you haven't given us that. On the other hand, I will say, as a positive note, I will say that I think we learned a lot today. Doing the economic side of things is slightly far field for the Jewish Policy Center. And I think that having you talk about these things and frankly being honest, even to the extent that we may face higher taxes and we may face, is a positive. And we appreciate your time. We appreciate your insights. And we appreciate learning from you. So Jim Capretta, thank you very much for making our lunch hour.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.